I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
Picture this. You're halfway through a DIY Carfix, tools scattered everywhere, and boom, you realize you're missing a part. It's okay, because you know whatever it is, it's on eBay. They've got everything. Brakes, headlights, cold air intakes, whatever you need. And it's guaranteed to fit, which means no more crossing your fingers and hoping you ordered the right thing. All the parts you need, at prices you'll love. Guaranteed to fit, every time. eBay. Things, people, love.
Hello and welcome to F1 Explains. My name is Christian Hughgill. This is Katie Osborne. Katie, hello.
Hello, Christian. This is the official F1 pod where you send us your questions and we find the experts to answer them. Christian, how are you? How are you? You doing all right today?
Yeah, no, I'm very well. I've been a bit slow today, so just bear with me a bit. And that's, by the way, no pun intended as to the topic we're doing, but I'm just my brain's taking a bit of ticking.
Well played.
Didn't even mean to.
God, you're good. You're good. We haven't even gotten to the topic, but he just lit a little lead into that. So, any guesses? We have had tons of questions on this week's topic is how F1 lap times are recorded.
I love doing this podcast, and I'm not just saying it because I'm on the podcast. You'd expect me to, wouldn't you? I wouldn't sit here and go, this podcast is rubbish, but I do genuinely love it. And one of the reasons I love it is because I've sat and watched so many Formula One Grand Prix over the years. And the timings have come up, whether it's on the sort of tower on the left side of the screen or in the centre. And never once have I thought, wonder how they do that. And then producer Chris said to me, do you know what? We've had loads of emails about the timing system, including, and this is not exclusively, by the way, Andre in Chile, Michael in Missouri, Nate in California, Liam in Bristol, plus Hunt, Nick, Karen, Alberto, and also Elliot in Canada. This is Elliot's email, in fact. He said, one could easily argue that a lap time is the most valuable commodity in F1. It is the most critical for deciding strategies, upgrades, pole positions, and of course, the race winner, amongst many other things. So my question is, how does Formula One track its vehicles and their times with such precision? This is such a good topic that I had never thought of. Well done, listeners. You've all done brilliantly well. This is fascinating.
Yeah, they are such great questions. We're going to find out how sensors, stopwatches, timing lines, and even notes on bits of paper make sure that every single lap time we see on our TV screens are recorded perfectly. F1 and the sports rulemakers, the FIA, work together on the timing system. We're going to get the answers to all of these questions from James Clark, who is one of the highly trained FIA-authorized timekeepers who works at every Grand Prix.
Now, Katie, this isn't exclusive. The timekeepers have a special office at a race. Would you like to know what it's called?
Why, yes, they would.
It's called the timing room.
God, brilliant.
You can
brilliant.
See why they've done it, can't you? You can see the logic in the names. Excellent. That is where I spoke to James in the timing room. I was in Miami. Katie, you were at home in New Hampshire. James was with me in the timing room, and this is what happened.
James, welcome to F1 Explains. We're so glad to have you. This topic is something that I think is really fascinating. And off the top, I can't imagine a lot of people really think twice about it because we all take it for granted. But the timing system, which might be the most important system in the entire sport, without it, we wouldn't know who gets pole position or the fastest lap. And of course, those are all the little details that all of us want to know all the time. So as an F1 timekeeper, how important would you say your job is?
Oh, crikey. Well, firstly, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, it's definitely an important system in Formula One. There's a lot of teams that support the role that we do in order to get the data into our system to be able to do the timing. And then where a lot of the fans will see the information, of course, is on the TV graphics as well. So there's definitely a nod to those guys as well, because I think that's where most people will see it. So it's a large operation to get that stuff out. But yeah, I think without it, we're going to get to a point about halfway through the race when some people are lapped and start losing count. So yeah, certainly an important system.
Let's go back to basics. What technology is on the cars? How do you keep track of where they are on the track and how quickly they're going?
So in terms of what we're using for the timekeeping, it is the car's transponder, which is placed on the front axle center line.
And that's a little box?
Yeah, it's probably... trying to think of the right sort of size for it.
I'm imagining it as like a matchbox.
No, it's much, much bigger than that.
Is it?
Yeah, it's kind of the size of a little bit bigger than a standard smartphone. Okay. Sort of size. It's a little bit kind of deeper than that.
Do you guys have toll passes in the UK? Like toll road passes?
Oh, I've seen them, Katie, but we don't in the UK. They're not really a British thing, are they?
I've seen them.
But that, in my mind, as a transponder for us stateside, that's, you know, when you get a rental car and it kind of has it on the dash.
Yes.
Or you can pay the Easy Pass, whatever, in my region.
I think if you knew what it was, James, you'd be with us. Katie, I think that's a very good description. And what exactly does a transponder do?
So effectively, the transponder, it works in conjunction with the timing loops, which are cut into the circuit. So if you actually look at the racetrack, you'll see on the finish line at the various points around the track that the loops are, like the sector points, the intermediate points, you'll actually see two parallel incisions down the track. And inside there, there's a wire... sort of thing that is called a loop. In there, that then plugs into a box called a decoder. And as the transponder goes over that, it effectively works like it's picking up a radio signal. So as the transponder goes over, that will kind of peak at a certain point, and that is how we retrieve the time of day of each passing.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because, again, stateside, anytime you go down a toll road, even in Florida, in Miami, where, you know, you guys are getting a chance to take in the sights and sounds and the heat, I guess, from Florida, that, you know, you drive around, and in my brain, that's exactly how I'm correlating what you're saying as an F1 timekeeper and how and why to keep it all making sense. It's basically triggering those transponders. Unfortunately, we have to pay the toll roads, and we are, you know, it's $1.99 or $1.50 or whatever when you're driving in the States for every time you cross and use your transponder. F1, it doesn't quite work that way, which is nice.
Yeah, and I suppose as well with what we're doing, it, you know, it has to be extremely precise onto that point. I suppose if you're following a truck or something on the, you know, on the roads, there'll be more than one camera to catch you at certain points. We have to make sure that we're getting it at the finish line every single lap. And it has to be that same point for everybody, which is where it kind of, you know, that technology kind of evolves into Formula One.
So we know what a transponder is. Now, we are up opposite the main grandstand in a room with big glass-fronted panels looking over the start-finish straight and the pit lane underneath us. You've got a desk in front of the glass panel and you're looking out onto the circuit. How does that transponder communicate with you, and how does your job come into that, James?
So the transponder will pick up on the loop. So let's just use the finish line. There's more than one loop around the circuit, but that will then come through the loop. It will get a time of day. It will say this transponder number, it's like an 8-digit number, has been registered at this time of day at this point on the circuit. That will go through the decoder, which will be at the side of the circuit, and then it will come back around the circuit via the fiber ring. And it will go to what's called the X2 server. The X2 server correlates all of this information for all of the loops around the circuit all the time. At which point, our system then comes in, and we receive all of these times in a raw form, and then we have to allocate in our system what transponder, you know, 8-digit code belongs to which car,
wow,
which driver that is, which team that is, what that means for the points.
So as you are seeing these 8-digit codes go across, there is a human that's actually responsible for saying, okay, that one happens to be Max, that one happens to be Sergio. Like, there is someone who is, and that's not computer generated?
Well, I suppose at some point, one of us humans is typing that number in. We're responsible for making sure that that list is up to date, and then a couple of the other teams will go out and check the transponders on the cars. You know, no one's moved them around. I mean, it's not just the Formula One that we're timing. We're responsible for timing the F1, the F2, the F3, any support series that comes along with us on the package. So, you know, in Japan, we were timing the Ferrari Challenge over there. So we give them transponders, and then we have to make sure that they're actually on the right car as well. And that's why having eyes up here is so important, because if somebody says, oh, we're meant to have transponder X on car one, and then car one goes past the window and it's not that transponder, it's a bit of a problem. So having the eyes upstairs, you know, looking on the track is so important to make sure that actually what we're seeing is that transponder is that car. It is actually what the system's saying is.
Because I guess no matter how good the technology, no matter how good the computers, things go wrong and you need the human eye to look at these big glass windows and what we're seeing down there.
Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of final point of truth, I suppose, isn't it? You know, if it says it's Max's transponder that crosses the line, but it isn't, we kind of need to know that.
And we all see the lap times come up as TV graphics. When we're watching at home, they flash up on the screen. Where are the actual lap times recorded? Is there a sort of actual clock with a second hand ticking somewhere, or is it all done by computer? How does that exact timing work that we see on the screen?
Yeah, so the way that's working is that we're not getting a lap time from the decoder. What we're getting is the time of day of the passing. So as those times of day come into our system, it's basically a subtraction. So you get the first time of day, you then take the second time of day off of that, and you end up with the difference is the lap time. So that's how that's working, and that's all done, you know, within the software that we've got in various places.
Hey, Christian, I think you had mentioned something about a timing loop, and just to have a better, deeper dive into what that is and how that is actually wired into this whole system, you know, James, I'm curious, is that something that each of these tracks, a timing loop, which as I understand it, are wires that run underneath the racetrack, are those built out for every racetrack? Do they shift and shimmy when a new track kind of comes on the schedule? Are you guys, okay, back to square one, we got to reevaluate how to put our timing loop in and all this? Like, how does that process actually work?
With the loops, I mean, they stay in situ, so it's a permanent installation. The times that they would move is, you know, if a circuit's resurfaced or something like that, then the guys would come out and cut those loops again. They go back into the same place just so that you can still compare data year on year. If you kept on moving intermediate points, the sector one time from the previous year would be not as helpful.
And that's what the transponder sort of communicates with, I guess. That the transponder going over the loop is what creates the time. I find myself saying creates time, which is a ridiculous thing to say, but you know what I mean. That's how the transponder and the, you know, that's the process, is it?
Yeah. So it's as the transponder goes over the loop, it'll pick up a signal.
Perfect.
Yeah, it creates that time of day.
James, do you find this to be so second nature to you that it's almost interesting that people are actually curious about timekeeping?
Yeah, I suppose so. I suppose, you know, when, you know, family and friends ask the question about it, they've lost interest and gone and done something else pretty quickly. So, I suppose it is interesting that people have asked questions about it, that there's an interest out there. I suppose it's something that the whole team are doing, you know, so often. Yeah, I suppose there is an element of that.
Well, F1 Explains has listeners in more than 100 countries across the world. And when they are interested in something, boy, do they tell us. And they have told us about this. So, yes, they really are interested. A couple of those people are Nate from California and Andre from Chile. They both want to know how precise is the timing system. So, for example, if we see a driver flash up with a 128.416, how close to 128.416 is it?
That is...
It's bang on.
That's the one, yeah. So it's to the thousandth of a second, and that's as the FIA International Sporting Code kind of agrees is the point of accuracy that can be guaranteed, and then it's, you know, our responsibility to make sure that all the kit is up to that spec.
And James will answer more of your timing questions in just a second on F1 Explains.
I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
Picture this. You're halfway through a DIY Carfix, tools scattered everywhere, and boom, you realize you're missing a part. It's okay, because you know whatever it is, it's on eBay. They've got everything. Brakes, headlights, cold air intakes, whatever you need. And it's guaranteed to fit, which means no more crossing your fingers and hoping you ordered the right thing. All the parts you need, at prices you'll love. Guaranteed to fit, every time. eBay. Things. People. Love.
This is F1 Explains. We're with James Clark. He's one of the highly trained FIA authorised timekeepers who works at every Grand Prix. Myself and Katie are asking James your questions on all things F1 timekeeping. And the next one is, what happens when two drivers set identical lap times in qualifying?
So at that point, it goes back to... So a lot of what we have to do in our role is kind of take these times and apply the sporting regulation logic to that and report that onto race control. So in that situation, it would go to whichever driver set that time first. So we would then just verify the order on the timing page is the order in which the driver set the lap time.
James, you mentioned there wasn't a ton of progression in the technology that is within timing. Is there a future in timing that you could see it moving into lasers or additional sensors, or, you know, built around, you know, movement built around the car to see if that is, you know, potentially going to be even more time, you know, inaccurate?
You know, that's the development on that side is something I'm less involved in. But I mean, in terms of, I mean, you say lasers, we've got a photocell, which is a light beam. It's not a laser, but it is effectively just, you can't see it. But you might hear Alex on the commentary sometimes saying, you know, it cuts the beam or breaks the beam. So there is a physical beam across the finish line, which we use as part of the backup system. So that's older technology that would have been used at the intermediate points in the past. Now we only use it on the finish line as that final backup, because the most important loop and the most important timing point on the circuit is the finish line, because that's where all of the lap times are kind of counting back to. So the way that works is that any time anything goes through that photocell beam and it breaks the beam, what will happen is that the independent timing room system will get a time of day. And then it is up to the operators upstairs to, again, look out of the window and say, yeah, that car that crossed the line was car one. And they will look out the window, type in car one. They will then send it on to what we call the check station. They will be writing a physical pen and paper list. And that will then, you know, if they've written down one, they'll send it down. If they've written down 11, thinks it's got the Red Bulls mixed up, he'll then, you know, confirm that with our finish line camera. Or he will then send that time down to the automatic system, and downstairs we will then take that time if a transponder fails, and that will become the passing for that loop in the event of a transponder failure.
Yeah, so that is so interesting that out of all of Formula One and all of its changes and ebbs and flows over the years with car shape, design, technology, design, engineering, I don't know, all these things, I love that there is such a basis and foundation that timing is what it is and there's no change. There's not a ton of change, right? I think that's just super fascinating. Michael in Missouri, you kind of mentioned the most important is the finish line, but there are track sectors as well. Why is a track split up into three different sectors?
I mean, but my understanding is that that's just a historical thing from what the teams have asked for in years gone by. So they're not always broken up into even sectors. I think Belgium's a pretty good example of it. You'll see that the first sector is, you know, all the way up to that kind of second straight up to the corners. So that's all about top speed. Then you've got sector two, which is all of the twisty corners. And then you've got the run back up to the finish line, which is, you know, a fast section again. So it's just so they can see, you know, we're going, you know, quick in the straights, or we've got downforce in the corners. And so a lot of them are in kind of historical positions, just kind of from what teams have asked for.
Now brace yourself for this one. This is from Liam in Bristol. It's a great question, but it is a slightly complex one from Liam. So here we go. Liam in Bristol asks, I've been watching F1 for several years, but something still confuses me. Please, can you explain how the lap times, intervals, and driver's times are determined during a race, and where on the track the official race clock starts? Does the clock start when they cross the start line or the finish line? Why are these sometimes not the same thing? It seems to me that the drivers at the back of the grid have to drive the length of the grid before their clock starts ticking to make sure the time comparisons with those at the front are fair. Or have I completely misunderstood this? Yours, confusingly, Liam in Bristol. I think times might confuse me most more than anything in F1, so Liam's question slightly breaks me.
I think this makes sense. I'm glad he asked it, because these are things are very confusing.
James,
it really is.
Clear this up for us.
Liam's got into some depth there, so thank you very much for the question. The way it works is that the race time starts when the lights go out. So when the red lights go out, that is the race start time, and that starts the clock for every driver. We have what's called a start line offset at some circuits, as Liam says. We've got one here. The one that I remember off the top of my head is that Japan is 300 meters from pole position to the finish line. So that first lap, we work out the total race distance of the number of laps times the circuit length minus the start line offset. But that offset always goes back to pole position. So in terms of your total race time, you're not at a time disadvantage, but yeah, the cars at the back have to go further, but that's always going to be the case. Because otherwise, if you were to have a photo finish at the end of a race, you wouldn't know where everyone was, if that makes sense. And then, yeah, from that point, all of the lap times are all going to the painted checkered finish line. So that first lap is shorter. But that's actually why the first lap isn't eligible for a fastest lap. So if you go back and have a look at that,
Thought of that. You see, well done, Liam. This is brilliant stuff.
Mind blown. Another F1 explains where both Christian, you and I are dumbfounded. Yeah. Thank you, Liam. And I do appreciate that he did sign it, yours confusingly, Liam. So he did get it. But I hope from this point forward, he's not confused anymore. And so are our listeners. I think that made a lot of sense. Thank you, James, for explaining that. You know, as a timekeeper, you said this is what, your eighth season. There has to have been a moment where you're like, well, this was a tough one. This was a hard scenario. Is that one you can share with us? Secret safe.
Oh,
good question.
Crikey. You've asked now.
This suggests there are some stories.
I don't know. Yeah, I mean, some races are slightly easier to handle than others. I think the races with red flags always throw up unique scenarios. Anything with a red flag really is a tricky one. Yeah, I mean, at that point, we're then responsible for confirming with race control what the restart orders are. So we then have to make sure that we've got the loop that all of the cars have managed to cross before the red flag came out, to make sure that we're getting the restart order correctly. And then we'll, you know, refer with them, see if they agree, answer any questions, and then once they've published it, make sure that we've got the right order in the system as well. So yeah, we're involved in that process, and that's slightly different from a, you know, lights to flag, no safety cars. You know, you effectively, if everything works, there's not a lot then to do when you're, you know, monitoring the automatic system. If there's no edits to make, then it's a nicer Sunday, or easier Sunday afternoon. But I don't know if that always necessarily makes it the most exciting race at home. So we often say that, you know, we're hoping for a less exciting race. And then if any of us are not working that event, we'll always be hoping for the opposite, because
we'll have to agree to
the entertainment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a little bit contradictory, isn't it? As a fan, I want the race to be exciting, but for the ease of my Sunday afternoon, I'd love for it to be a little bit less so.
James, another thing our listeners ask about a lot is how people got into their roles in Formula One. How did you get into being a timekeeper? I find that a fascinating route into F1.
Yeah, I still ask myself that.
How did I get here?
So I mean, we've all got very different stories, but mine was I was doing TV production at university, and I wasn't enjoying it as much as I thought. So I just kind of stayed back one day, applied for some jobs on the internet. I think I applied for 5 jobs. I'm still waiting to hear back from 4 of them, but this one got back. So yeah,
this one I'll do.
3 interviews later. Yeah, 3 interviews later at a big surprise. I found myself in Canada, which was pretty amazing, really.
Is there a specific skill set that's needed to be a timekeeper? Like, do you have to be good with numbers?
I think a passion for Formula One and motorsport in general, actually. You know, the majority of the time as timekeepers for F1, we're timing something that's not F1. So just a passion for motorsport in general. There's a lot of different rules that we have to know for all the different series. So kind of if you're only interested in one, it could be a little bit difficult to kind of keep your attention going on the 12th hour of the day. You have got to have a passion for that motorsport. And I think, a good attention to detail. You know, we're looking at a lot of numbers, and a lot of it is patterns. I mean, being good with numbers helps.
That would absolutely not serve me whatsoever. Numbers are hard.
I couldn't agree more. And luckily, we've got a very strong team that's very good at supporting my shortfalls in that area. Having that kind of base knowledge, or at least, you know, knowing how to use the calculator to kind of get yourself to the right answers. It's a very niche form of mathematics in order to kind of understand the timekeeping side of it. My former boss, the guy that hired me, so if you're listening, cheers, Steve. When I was training to get my UK timing license, he put me in the timing room in Hungary and said, right, manually timing. It was literally just with a clock and a button that I had to press when the cars crossed the line. And he said, right, tell me the lap times for the Red Bulls. So it was an hour and a half practice session.
Wow.
And I had a button, a pen, and some paper. And basically every time I pressed the button, you get a time of day on a till roll receipt to come out. So I have to write down that time of day, keep an eye out for the next one, make sure you're not getting the two mixed up, then do the manual subtraction to get the lap time. And yeah, it's tricky because you're working... Well, because for the first 3 numbers, for the minute and the seconds, you're working to base 6 because you're counting up for a minute, and then for the
pressure
temps,
to like to perform your math skill like real fast. Like in elementary school, we did Around the World, where it was like you had to do quick, you know, add, subtract to like get ahead of the next person, and like the pressure you must feel to make sure you do it accurately and perfectly every single time.
Yeah, it was very tricky. I mean, I think back in the day, you'd have timekeepers doing, you know, up to 7 cars that'd be responsible for in a session, or tracks that are shorter than Hungary. And, you know, it's a very tricky thing. I was lucky to only have to do 2. But I tell you what, that was the quickest 90 minutes of my life.
Oh, I bet.
Because
staggering.
You're constantly looking. But, you know, I'm really glad I got to do that. Because, I mean, back in the day, that would have been a lot closer to how timekeeping would have been back then, and it kind of shows you how far it's come. I mean, now we're extremely lucky that even with the what we're calling the manual system, we at least don't have to do the maths to go with it. You can focus on the cars crossing the line, because let me tell you, when you get the first lap of a Porsche race and 32 Porsches come past you at 120 mile an hour in about 5 seconds,
good luck.
You've still got to get all of those cars.
Are you really good at identifying the cars then, especially what if they change liveries and all that? Is that part of the skill set?
Yeah, I mean, the guys up here, I mean, the usual guy up here is Ben. Ben is extremely good at doing that. So he's au fait with kind of knowing the onboard camera colors on the cars, which is the main help. Because, I mean, trying to spot the numbers on the cars sometimes is not always the easiest task.
No, I can well imagine.
It's tricky. And then, you know, when cars are crossing the line together, you know, only the first car is going to break the beam. A second one will sneak through. So we've got to understand that, you know, there was an overlap, or there's sometimes, I think the most we've had is 5 cars cross the line under 1 passing of the beam. So you've then got to identify which order those cars were in, what numbers they were, and then be able to look up and get the next 10 that are coming past the window. And it is tricky. I mean, luckily, and an advancement in the technology for you is the finish line camera that we've got. We've actually got two. Yeah, you might actually see them on the TV coverage if you look around the finish line. There are two cameras on poles kind of opposite each other. And they work to 20,000 frames per second, and they work as a line scanner. So if, you know, in those sorts of situations, inevitably, we're going to want to check. So that's how we'd kind of verify that in the event of a photo finish. You might have actually seen, I think, was it Austria in 2023 last year? There was a very close finish in the sprint between Ocon and Russell. And I think the picture was circulated on social media. So that was from, you know, the official timing system camera, and that's what that looks like. So if you go back and look at it, that's a good one to kind of describe what they look like, because it's not a normal picture, let's put it that way.
And just finally, James, before we let you go, because you're a busy man on a race weekend here in Miami, a cool thing to mention is I understand that you have a specific qualification to do this job.
Yeah, so in order to sign off the result as the timekeeper in Formula One, we need to have our own super licenses. So kind of like the drivers. I mean, it's much easier to get the one that I have than the one that the drivers have. But yeah, there's a few of us that have it outside of the driving. The official starter has one. The race director has one. It's basically just to say that we're, you know, an accredited person that can be trusted to confirm that the result is correct and be able to answer these questions, you know, from race control live in a session, and make sure that we're not going to give the wrong information. Basically, it's just making sure that we're up to scratch. So there's a few of us in the team now that have got it. I think is there five of us?
James, what you do is fascinating. I can't imagine doing a lot of the things that you've described doing. It's just not
starting,
my skill set.
Starting with numbers.
Numbers. Yeah, exactly, Katie. Exactly. So honestly, thank you so much for sharing your role with us and what you do. It's great to be able to shine a light on it, because you're one of the unsung heroes of us all getting to enjoy Formula One all around the world because of people like yourself doing a fantastic, unique job. So James, thanks so much for doing what you do and taking the time to explain it to us here on F1 Explains.
Oh, no problem at all. Thank you very much for having me on the show, and hopefully that's answered some of the listeners' questions.
So that is how all those lap times end up on our TV screens. I am blown away that so much goes into it. But like Elliot in Canada said in his email, time is the most important commodity in F1. Isn't that like, isn't time the most important commodity in life? Couldn't we like go deeper dive into...
I was going to say this at the start of the episode. Elliot in Canada is quite Oh God, hang on a minute. What do I mean? I can't say that word. Do you know what I mean?
I do. It's a good philosopher.
Yes.
He's a philosophizing man.
So is it a philosophical, producer Chris says to me. Philosophical. I just couldn't get that. Philosophical. Excellent. Yeah. A very philosophical question, which I enjoyed. You know, you can write to us with your philosophical thoughts if you want. Why not? I mean, I don't think I'm particularly intelligent enough to read them, but you can send them in by all means.
Stop it. Thanks to James, and thanks to all of you who have sent such great questions on this topic. Maybe you, yes, you have something that you've always wondered about, like Elliot and all of the others. Write us an email, send us a voice note to f1explains@f1.com, and as we said at the very top of the show, we'll find the expert to give you the answer.
And Katie, we've been going a while now, so if you need something else to listen to, don't forget about the back catalogue. You can choose one of our previous episodes. We've had Fernando Alonso on recently, Oscar Piastri, the quickfire with Bernie Collins and Ruth Buscombe, where we talked about little hand knobs. That was good, wasn't it, Katie? We enjoyed little hand knobs. Yeah, they are all there for you. Just scroll through this feed.
And also, you can listen to F1 Nation and F1 Beyond the Grid with our F1 podcast teammate, Tom Clarkson. Yes, Christian?
I've actually got breaking news on the other podcasts with Tom. Katie, I made my debut on F1 Nation after the Miami Grand Prix.
Now, how'd it go?
It went very well. I thoroughly enjoyed it. The one thing I would say is I'm now tracking how I can get onto F1 Beyond the Grid. I think I'm going to have to become a bit more famous for Tom to interview me, unfortunately, on that one. So,
But you know somebody who knows somebody, so that's a good start.
Well, producer Chris produces it. Yeah, he does. But I'm going to have to sort of pitch it to him that if I'm going to get interviewed for that, I need to do some more interesting things with my life because I'm a fundamentally quite dull man. So hopefully one day I'll make it onto that one as well and I can tick off all three. That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Oh my gosh, that would be such a good listen. That would be such a good listen.
Anyway, do listen to those. F1 Nation, F1 Beyond the Grid with Tom. We'll be back with more F1 Explains next week. Bye for now.
Goodbye.
Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Consult a doctor prior to use. You look great. What have you been doing?
I found Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe the same active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s for 80 to 90% less without insurance. All of mine shipped right to your door.
Get started with Zelthy today for just $39. Call pound 250 and say keyword CARE. That's CARE to pound 250.